Hey guys, this is our weekly podcast by Cornerstone Church of Ione. We're so glad that you decided to join. We are a church family passionate about seeing people worship Jesus, grow in their faith, and serve those around them. If you would like to learn more about Cornerstone, please visit us at cornerstoneione.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
I like the one service. Everybody together, Cornerstone Church together, seeing each other, seeing who's not here, causing us to check in with those people, or constantly developing those relationships, and then coming together, communing together, and together praising God and glorifying God, learning together and connecting, lives intertwined. I just love that about the one service, and I do worry a bit about dividing the group. So, you know, we could, though, still go to two services and we all show up at the same service. And then we'll just have to figure something out. And I don't know what we'd do with that, though. Also, I do notice that over the course of the year, there's a bunch of new people here. I just want to take a moment and just say that if you haven't known, if you are really welcome here, I just want to officially say that we love that you're here. Welcome to Cornerstone, and if you ever need anything or have questions or thoughts or want to talk to a pastor and elder, we do have an open door policy, and not only is that open door there, but it's easy to get to. If you go to our website, all of our elder and pastor information's on there. You'll see me up here regularly. You can even find the elders through any of the people that are up here at any time, or just ask, and we would love to meet with you. We would enjoy that. Typically, we have a bulletin that has all the contact stuff right on the back. We haven't had that for a year or so since we've been out here, but when we go back indoors, you will have that. So, anyway, just officially welcome. Glad you're here. You're absolutely welcome here, and we're glad about it. So, with that, I do want to start off by talking about children's church. If you have kids, go ahead and send them back to Joe and Crystal LaBar. And remember that even over at the grass lot, we want you to go to the church to pick the kids up. Here, they're going to that animal pen area. And still, after service, go get those kids. It makes it easier on them to hand them off to the kids. I mean, hand the kids off to the parents and everything. So send them back there. They will take them to the various children's hour area, and then make sure don't leave your kid here when you leave. So what I'd like to start off with now is talking about me graduating high school and going off to the beginning of my undergrad. And I went to Boise Bible College. That's over in Boise. And yeah, I actually really did love it there. I plan on just living there my whole life, but God had other plans, I think. So anyways, I went out there. I was trying to figure out what school to go to. It made it a little bit easier because I got a full tuition music scholarship there. So obviously that makes it easier, right? When they're like, hey, you don't have to pay like an eighth of what you normally have to pay. You're like, okay, fine. I choose you. So I went, and I went to Boise Bible College. And it was my first time. I just moved away, and I was really excited about it. I love my parents, love the house environment, but also I just was really excited to get out on my own. And one of the silly things that went through my mind when I'm thinking about being on my own, making my own decisions, growing up, you know, being a man, one of the things that I remember thinking is that when I get my own place, I will have one of those 5-gallon buckets of licorice. And I can eat it whenever I want. Nobody's going to tell me when I can have it, when I can't. I'm just going to eat one whenever I want. And that was legitimately one of the things I was excited about in moving out and being on my own, is I can eat licorice whenever I want. And you can't tell me when not to. The other side of that, I remember I'd moved out. I went to Boise Bible College, got my dorm. I went to take a shower. I got in there and I was looking around. I'm like, where is all the soap? And I realized, I'm like, I'll have to buy that. And a lot of dots were connected as I stood there in the shower, just literally just getting wet for 30 minutes. That's all I did. I just let the water like hit me because I had nothing else to do in there. So then I got out. But it was an interesting time, I thoroughly enjoyed it. My personality, I just like going out on my own and, you know, I'm going to figure things out. I'm going to do it. And I remember going to the preview time for the college, and they were saying, now, you know, being homesick is a real thing, you know, and you know, we really want to support you as you like move out on your own, and you're gonna, you know, you might find yourself being really sad and talking through all what homesickness is. I'm like, what is this? What are we, kindergarten? Come on, like, I'm fine. Show me where the cafeteria is at and how that system works. I don't need to know about homesickness. There was a point, day three, laying in my dorm thinking, I'm going home. I'm not doing this. And I did experience a little bit of homesickness. It was really weird. So one way I coped is I would go and visit, right? And part of my music scholarship had me busy on the weekends, but one weekend a month we had off, and I would almost always drive back to Washington from Idaho and visit my family. Well, really, I want to see Emily. But, you know, I'd go and I would see my parents too. And I love my parents and they're great. But really, in my mind, I'm like, I haven't seen Emily for a long time. I want to go see Emily. And so I had this system. When you make that drive, you know, several times, pretty soon, you know where you fill up. You know how many snacks you need to get through to the next gas station. You know how many CDs. I don't know. There's probably people here that literally are like, what's a CD? There's, you know, how many CDs you need to get through the entire trip. And some was music, some was sermons. And, you know, of course, I had big subs. They're the big speakers in the back that just make rumbly noises. And I would get all my, like, Pringles and sunflower seeds and, you know, gummy bears and whatever in there. I'd fill up in my Jeep Grand Cherokee. They got, like 8 miles to the gallon if you were going downhill, and I just would go and I'd turn the music up and I'd just drive, and then I knew where my gas station was. I'd fill back up and then I'd make it the rest of the way. Well, I made that drive a lot, and pretty soon I did start driving faster and faster and faster and faster. And as trips went on, I began to get a little bit more comfortable in the Jeep, and I just kind of get in this position that felt comfortable. I just would cruise and cruise and cruise and cruise. And down hills, I would just floor it. It's a Jeep Grand Cherokee, like 4.0 high output. There's no high output in it. Like, just floor it down the hill and then hopefully make it up the other side. And I remember one time I was driving and I was flooring it down a hill, and I don't know how fast I was going. You know, you go above 30 and the thing shakes, so you kind of lose track of how fast you're going. And I go to sit up, and as I sit up, I see red and blue lights in my rearview mirror, like right on me. And turns out he had been following me for a long time, and he thought he was in a pursuit with me. I just had my subs turned up so much, my music so loud, I couldn't hear it. And I was slouching. I had no mirrors. I couldn't see behind me. And so as soon as I sat up, I mean, I had a lump in my throat. The thud was my heart to the floor. I didn't know what was going to happen there. So I pulled over. Long story short, 94 and 65, got a speeding ticket. And I went to court for it, which was probably stupid in hindsight. But they asked me, why do you think you shouldn't get this ticket? And I didn't think about the question they're going to ask me. But I said, well, I probably deserve the ticket because I was going 94 and a 65. And I literally told this judge, I told her, I didn't know my car could go 94. But I said, the ticket is worth more than my car. And so I'm just looking for some grace. That's literally what I said. And she said, are you saying that you were speeding? And I was like, I was for sure speeding. And she goes, well, I appreciate your honesty. I'll cut it in half. She cut it in half. So I appreciate it. But I had to go to court for that. And we are all familiar in one way or another with the court system. If you ask people if you have ever been to court, many of us have for one reason or another been to court. And in general, the court system works like this. You have Superior Court. That handles criminal cases. It handles your traffic citations. You know, everything from top to bottom really goes to, you know, well, I guess unless it's a federal crime, I guess, but hopefully we haven't really been there. But, you know, from the other side, you go to your Superior Court and they make a ruling and there's a verdict and there's sentencing. And then if you don't like that ruling, you take it to a higher court, probably appellate court, and you deal with it there. And if you still don't like that, you can apply to have something heard in our Supreme Court. And that is like the highest court in the land, right? So what we are going to do is we're going to look. I know our text we read is 13 verses or something. We're going to read 40 verses this morning. And what we're going to look at is the trial that Jesus went through, the court proceedings that Jesus went through. Because have you ever wondered why we see Caiaphas and then there's a verdict, right? They say guilty, he deserves to die. And they're like, okay, now we're going to take him to Pilate. And you're like, why are they going to Pilate? And so we have to understand this court system a little bit. So we're going to look at that. Let's start off. We're going to just read a little bit. I'm going to stop. We're going to talk about it. We're going to read a little bit, stop and talk about it. And we're going to work through this text so that we kind of understand what this court, what this trial, what these courts look like. We'll start in chapter 26 of Matthew, verses 57 through 68. Then the people who had arrested Jesus led him to the home of Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of religious law and the elders had gathered. Meanwhile, Peter followed him at a distance and came to the high priest's courtyard. He went in and sat with the guards and waited to see how it would all end. Inside, the leading priests and the entire council were trying to find a witness who would lie about Jesus so that they could put him to death. It doesn't sound good going into that, right? If you were going in, if you were accused of something, you're going in, they're like, well, we're trying to find somebody who will lie about you so we can put you to death. That's not what you want to walk in. That doesn't seem like a fair trial. But what we see is Jesus betrayed in the garden. He's arrested. He's brought to the home of Caiaphas. Caiaphas is the high priest. He's kind of the head of the Sanhedrin here. And the scribes and the elders were gathered. So the Sanhedrin, think of it this way. Cities had what's called lesser Sanhedrins. They weren't creative with their words, but it's lesser Sanhedrins. They're smaller. They're 23 judges, and that's kind of like your superior court. You go there for everything. They try you there. They make verdicts, and they can even give sentencing there. And then they have the great Sanhedrin. Again, not super creative, but you understand what the great Sanhedrin is. This is 71 judges, and this is like the highest court, and it's centered in this area we're talking about. And so they bring Jesus to most likely the great Sanhedrin, 71 judges. It says that they are already gathered. They're already there. So this is all part of the plan. Because usually when somebody's arrested towards the night, what you don't have is a group of 71 people sitting around waiting for a case to drop. But they're there, it's planned, they knew the betrayal, they have gathered, and they're waiting. And what are they waiting for? There's no mystery, because it says they want to find people who will give false testimony, they'll lie about Jesus, so then they can put him to death. Because we've seen over and over again throughout Matthew that as he gains power and influence, the religious leaders who should be accepting him as the promised and long-awaited Messiah, as he rises to power, they say, no, we got to get rid of this guy. Why? Because he's taken away their power and taken away their ability to essentially worship themselves and be in power themselves. They want to be king. They don't want King Jesus. So over and over again, we see that they're trying to trip him up. They're trying to discredit him. They're trying to get Jesus out of the picture. And they're to the point now where, like, he's got to be killed. So they have Judas betray him. They bring him to the great Sanhedrin. They're already met there. They're waiting for Jesus to arrive. It's a plan. It's a false trial. Because they're looking for people who will testify falsely against him so that they could put him to death. That's what's happening. So they take him to Caiaphas. The way this works, Romans will come in and they'll take over a land and they'll be the supreme ruler of a land. And in a way to minimize all of the minutiae of stuff, as well as to keep favor with the people, they would allow, like in this sense, they let the Jews and the Sanhedrin keep going about their business. Like, you can still do your own little trials and stuff among your people. We are king. Tiberius is king. We are in control of this, but we'll allow you to carry on these little sentencings and things like that. So that's why they bring him to Caiaphas, because the Sanhedrin, the Roman government, has said, okay, we'll allow you to still do those trials and things like that. So they bring them there. They need two witnesses to agree. We know that from previous sermons. Several times we've brought up that that's the standard. Essentially, two men to agree on the same thing, corroborate each other, and say, this is the crime, this is what he did, I was a witness there, this is my testimony. Another person says it, it's fact. They can create a verdict, they can do their sentencing. Verse 60, but even though they found many who agreed to give false witnesses, so they found several people who were willing, hey, I'll come and I'll give a false witness, I'll make up something. They could not use anyone's testimony. Finally, two men, so you got the two, right? And then two men came forward who declared, this man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, well, and by the way, them standing up is not typical. This is a big dramatic scene here. Well, aren't you going to answer these charges? What do you have to say for yourself? But Jesus remained silent. Then the high priest said to him, I demand in the name of the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. So first off, the accusation is that Jesus said that he could destroy the temple and then rebuild it in 3 days. If we go back to John chapter 2, verses 18 through 21, we see what Jesus actually said there. The Jews then responded to him. And this is after he flipped all the tables. He goes in. This is the account of John when Jesus goes in and cleanses the temple, flips everything over. The Jews then respond to him, what sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this? And Jesus answered them, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. So they took what Jesus said, they altered a bit, and they gave it to Caiaphas. Does that make sense? Because Jesus didn't say, I'm going to come in here in this context, he never said, I'm going to go in and I'm going to destroy this temple. I'm going to rip down these walls and then I'll rebuild it in 3 days. So they took what Jesus said, they twisted it, they distorted it, they gave it to Caiaphas, and Caiaphas goes through the roof. Jesus remains silent when asked from Caiaphas. There's going to be at least two times we see Jesus remain silent. That's like unheard of in these trials. You go back to secular historians. You go back to even, I think even in Matthew, Pilate is going to say he was amused or something about his silence. The silence is like unheard of. That never happens. You defend yourself. And as you see how this trial started, you can see why you'd want to be on your toes to defend yourself. Because it's like, hey, we're looking for people to lie about you because we want to kill you. You're going to defend yourself. You're going to be on your toes, right? Isaiah 53:7 was fulfilled here. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was like a lamb led to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Several times he remained silent, which totally caught everybody off guard in this. But it's fulfilling this prophecy as he's like a lamb led to the slaughter, that he would be silent. And there's other instances where he was silent. In the name of the living God, I thought of this. I'm like, oh, this is like the pinky swear. I'm like, no. The more I thought about it, when he stood up and Caiaphas said, in the name of the living God, it's like, for kids, it's like the truth or dare. Like you got to pick, oh, do I want to tell the truth? Because I'd have to tell the truth. Or the dare, but I'd have to do it. And then you say truth. And they ask you a question. And that obligation to answer truthfully is essentially what's being said here. This is something where almost by law, you had to answer and you had to tell the truth. I don't know what all the other stuff was then, but this was a time where you had to tell the truth. It says, tell us if you are the Messiah. The initial testimony given was that he was going to destroy the temple and rebuild it, right? So why now is he asking if he's the Messiah? That's important. It's going to come in later. What the witness has said is that he's going to destroy the temple, he's going to rebuild it. What is being asked now is, are you the Messiah? Are you the king? Are you the king of the Jews? That's what's being asked. And there's going to be a reason for that. Verse 64, Jesus replied, "You have said it." And that phrase is essentially saying yes without saying yes. Saying like, hey, I didn't say those words, you did. But it's like implied yes. So it's this interesting way to say yes without saying yes. He says, "You have said it." And in the future, you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothing off to show his horror and said, "Blasphemy. Why do we need other witnesses? You have all heard this blasphemy. What is your verdict?" "Guilty," they shouted. "He deserves to die." So they found him. "Are you the Messiah?" He says, "I'm the Messiah." And in the future, you will see the Son of Man. You will see the Messiah seated in the place and the power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds with heaven. He gets up, rips his clothes off, which we don't really do that in our culture if we get, you know, really excited. But that's what happened here. Proves his point. The horror of this, starts ripping his clothes off. Says, "What else do we need?" And essentially the answer is nothing. He's guilty. What do you want? He deserves death. He just claimed to be the Messiah, to be king over all. Fascinatingly enough, there are sermons written about the six ironies of the trials, or the seven ways they broke the Jewish law to convict Jesus, or the four ways that they proved Jesus was Jesus while trying not to prove that Jesus was Jesus. I'll just point out one way to show that these religious leaders were willing to do whatever it took to get Jesus killed and out of the picture. And several times they broke their own laws, their own rules, in order to have this trial have a verdict and a sentencing. In the Mishnah, which is the first rabbinic literature that was created and bound and put together for the sake of compiling all the Jewish laws and oral traditions. And in there, it says several things in how to operate within this Sanhedrin. And one of the things was, I'll just go over one of them, was that you cannot try somebody for these crimes and have a verdict the same day. Essentially, you have to sleep on it. But they break their own rules in order to, okay, we got that. All right, verdict, guilty. What does he deserve? Death. Let's go to Pilate. And off they go. They make the verdict that night. And then the very next morning, and this is chapter 27, 1 through 2, so we're moving on in our text now. Chapter 27. Yay, applause for moving on in a chapter. Right, we're in the next chapter. Okay, verse 27, 1 through 2. "Very early in the morning, the leading priests and the elders of the people met again to lay plans for putting Jesus to death. They bound him and led him and took him to Pilate, the Roman governor." So they make their verdict. The next day, they're not making a verdict. That's already been done. Now they're binding him up. They're like, this is how we're going to get Pilate to convict him, to give him the death sentence. Because we already talked about that there's these different roles. One of the things, when the Roman government would take over an area, they'd say, you can do your little trials like, oh, he slapped me in the face, he spit on my donkey, whatever, and you can handle all that there. But they said, the death penalty is reserved for us. We will deal with the death penalty. So how do you put Jesus to death? Caiaphas can't do it. The Sanhedrin can't do it. They got to go to the Roman governor so that a Roman official can say he deserves the death penalty and then hand him over. So I don't know if there was ever a gap for you there, but there was for me, and now I know. That's why they had to take him to Pilate. It's because of that death penalty, because the Romans said, we are the only ones that have the power to sentence somebody to death. So what are they going to do? They get up in the morning, they make this great plan, they say, we are going to put Jesus to death, we need to take him to Pilate, so let's go. They load him up, and they go. Because they need that Roman governor to sentence him to death. Then we have, in the next little section of text, we have Judas hangs himself. Three weeks ago, we talked about this. It's also on YouTube and our Facebook. It was posted on the 25th or 26th. So if you're curious about that, you can go take a look at that. But now, we're going to skip past that since we already covered the Judas portion, and we're going to go back into the trials. And so now we are going to be in verse 11. Now Jesus was standing before Pilate, the Roman governor. "Are you the king of the Jews?" the governor asked him. So there it is, right? Initially, what they had people agree on was that we heard Jesus say that he's going to destroy the temple and that he can rebuild it in 3 days. Well, then they make the jump. Well, if he says he can rebuild it in 3 days, he's claiming to be the Messiah. We already know that's one of the things that we're upset with. So, hey, are you the Messiah? He says, yes, I'm the Messiah. I'm the king. They take him over to Pilate. Pilate asks right out the gate, hey, are you the king of the Jews? If Jesus says yes, that is a violation. It would be considered insurrection, because Tiberius is the king of the Jews, and Tiberius doesn't play with anyone. He's the king of the Jews. There's no Jesus that's king of the Jews or king of anything. I am the king, says Tiberius. So that's why he asks him right at the gate. Pilate asks. In verse 63, the question is, tell us if you're the Messiah, the Son of God. And then now we get really to what's going on here. Pilate flat out asks, are you the king of the Jews? Now here we go. This is verses 12 through about 21. But when the leading priests and the elders made their accusations against him, Jesus remained silent. Again, part of that fulfilling that prophecy. Don't you hear all these charges they're bringing against you, right? That's a good question for Pilate to ask, because everybody knows in this environment that the penalty for this is death. And then Pilate asks him a question, gives him an opportunity to respond and get out of this. And we're going to see later that Pilate knew the Jews were up to no good. He knew the Sanhedrin was up to no good. So he's giving him a chance to answer. And then he says, hey, don't you hear, don't you understand what they're charging you with? The accusation against you, defend yourself. But Jesus made no response to any of the charges, much to the governor's surprise. And that's part, if you look at that, much to the governor's surprise, he's kind of enamored a bit with Jesus' response. Verse 15. Now it was the governor's custom each year during the Passover celebration to release one prisoner to the crowd, anyone they wanted. Now think about this. Think politically, why would somebody start doing this? Why would Pontius Pilate start doing this? Release one criminal, whoever the people want, I'll release them. I don't think it's because Pilate's like a really gracious guy. It's a political move to keep and gain favor. So they have this thing that they release a criminal. So whoever the community has heard about, you know, and I think we've experienced this too, we're like, hey, that person's wrongly convicted, you know, they should be set free, they should exonerate that man. Well, what happened is Pontius Pilate would say, who do you want? And there would be everybody be all upset, you know, I want this person, I want this person to do anything. And he's like, all right, I'll take care of it, people. And then he's set him free, and people would be like, man, that Pontius Pilate guy, what a great guy. He just let this guy go. You know, there was somebody that was innocent that was going to be punished, and you know, this Pontius Pilate guy, he's got his head screwed on straight. Well, this guy's name is Barabbas. This year, there was a notorious prisoner, a man named Barabbas. As the crowds gathered before Pilate's house that morning, he asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Messiah? He knew very well that the religious leaders had arrested Jesus out of envy. Let's pause there for a moment. Pontius Pilate sees what's happening. He's no goon. He knows what the Sanhedrin and what the Jews are trying to do. And he's probably known about it. He's the governor. He knows what's been going on. All the feathers that have been ruffled up. And he knows they're up to no good. So then he says, hey, what I'll do is I'll do this Barabbas thing. He's notorious. They will say to let him go, because he knows they're up to no good. Just then, as Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him this message. Now, this wasn't a text. This was probably more like something written down or a oral message sent through a messenger. Although in current day, yeah, it would be a text. The phone would go off and he'd look at his phone and go, oh, she had another dream. Okay. She says, I suffered through a terrible nightmare about him last night. Oh, he says, leave the innocent man alone. I suffered through a terrible nightmare about him last night. Meanwhile, the leading priests and elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas to be released and for Jesus to be put to death. So the governor asked again, which of these do you want to be released to you? The crowd shouted back, Barabbas. The religious leaders are going around convincing people, hey, ask for Barabbas, ask for Barabbas. Barabbas was a robber, he was a thief, and he was a murderer. The only reason scholars can come up with that possibly the reason why they wanted him released is maybe he was more of a Robin Hood fellow. Like he would victimize the rich. He wouldn't mess with the poor, which were the commoners, which were the majority. It would always be the rich he'd go take care of. He'd go hem them up, they'd go rob them, go steal them, he'd go murder them. And so it was kind of like Barabbas was the stick it to the man type of guy. And they were able to say, hey, Barabbas really isn't that bad of a guy. Let him go. Where Pilate obviously is thinking, they're not going to let the murderer go. They're not going to say, let the murderer go. They're going to say, this guy that's claiming to be the Messiah, that's going around teaching and healing people, you're going to let him go. But they choose Barabbas. And you know, it's in the Lord's plan that they choose Barabbas. Which probably has several sermons in itself. Several implications in itself that they chose Barabbas and they needed to choose Barabbas because Jesus needed to get to the cross. And Jesus wants to get to the cross. Pilate responded, then what should I do with Jesus who's called the Messiah? And they shouted back, crucify him. Why? Pilate demanded. What crime has he committed? But the mob roared even louder, crucify him. Pilate saw that he wasn't getting anywhere and the riot was developing. So he sent for a bowl of water and he washed his hands before the crowd saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. The responsibility is yours. And all the people yelled back, we will take responsibility for his death, we and our children. So Pilate released Barabbas to them. He ordered Jesus to be flogged with a lead-tipped whip, then turned him over to the Roman soldiers to crucify him, because it is the Romans that must do the carrying out of the death sentence. The innocent man is crucified for sins. The religious leaders were corrupt. The testimonies were corrupt. Pilate knew he was innocent, and the mob was forming. Keep in mind the time of year, the Passover. He says, I wash my hands of this. If you want to crucify him yourself. Hands him over to be flogged, which was often a death sentence in itself, where they would take a whip that had materials woven into the leather, and they would whip him, oftentimes exposing bone and intestines, and they would die from that in itself. And then he goes on to be crucified. A few days earlier, when he came into Jerusalem, they shouted Hosanna as Jesus entered the city, and now they're shouting crucify him. If there were 3 points to this sermon, 3 of those points could be he was innocent. He did no wrong and he never sinned. If there is anybody that didn't deserve to be put to death, it would be Jesus. Because we know he was sinless. And yet there he is as he gives himself onto the cross. It wasn't that he was guilty and so then he was taken. He was actually innocent. He could have refuted and he didn't. He kept silent. And it was prophesied that he'd keep silent. If he would have defended himself, he would have been set free. But Jesus knew that his job, my job, what I came to do was to die on the cross for the atonement of sins. And he was determined to do it, even though several verses earlier, he was on his hands and knees saying, take this cup of suffering from me unless it's your will. And if it's your will, I'm going to do it. His answer from the Father was, this is the way. So he stands up and he gives himself on the cross for us. I want to close with reading Isaiah chapter 53. Many of us have read Isaiah 53. Many of us have read Isaiah 53 in conjunction with this text. The idea is that this text should be read with texts like Matthew chapter 26 and 27. Let's read what Isaiah prophesied about hundreds of years before Jesus ever even was born of a virgin. This is what was said. This is what was prophesied about this Messiah. Who has believed our message? To whom has the Lord revealed his powerful arm? My servant grew up in the Lord's presence like a tender green shoot, like a root in dry ground. There was nothing beautiful or majestic about his appearance, nothing to attract us to him. He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way. He was despised and we did not care, yet it was our weakness he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. But he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so that we could be whole. He was whipped so we could be healed. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. We have left God's path to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of all of us. He was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep is silent before the shearers. He did not open his mouth. Unjustly condemned, he was led away. No one cared that he died without descendants, that his life was cut short in midstream. But he was struck down for the rebellion of my people. He had done no wrong and had never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave. But it was the Lord's good plan to crush him and cause him grief. Yet when his life is made an offering for sin, he will have many descendants. He will enjoy a long life, and the Lord's good plan will prosper in his hands. When he sees all that is accomplished by his anguish, he will be satisfied because of his experience. My righteous servant will make it possible for many to be counted as righteous, for he will bear all of their sins. I will give him the honor of victorious soldier because he exposed himself to death. He was counted among the rebels. He bore the sins of many and interceded for the rebels. That moment in the trials was necessary because of the mission of Jesus. He came to save. And Jesus knew, he predicted, I'm going to the cross, because God so loved the world that he sent me, and I came to die on the cross for sins. So that anyone who places their faith in me and repents of their sins, that you can be saved and that you can be made righteous, because you can impute your sin on me in the cross, and I will impute my righteousness to you, so that when essentially the Lord looks down on the ones who are redeemed, they see the works of Christ and not ours, because we have nothing to boast in. It's all in the work of Christ. And Jesus knew that this moment here, they had to choose Barabbas. I had to remain silent. They had to yell, crucify me. They had to take me off. They had to flog me, and they had to nail me to the tree. to accomplish his work of redeeming you and I back to the Father when he deserved none of it because he did no wrong and he was innocent. If I had to come up with another point of the sermon, it could be this. This was public. Because this goes back to the confidence we have. This is a piece of the confidence. This was not some private shade tree, backwoods, little thing that happened, then that eked and seeked and weeped its way through the forest and out to the public, and they heard of this man named Jesus. The most popular time of year in the biggest city, the most popular place, the highest officials, all were there, and it was documented that Jesus Christ was led to the cross. He gave himself on the cross to redeem people from their sins. His message accomplished on the cross because of what Christ did and not us. So we read Isaiah 53 as we see it begin to be fulfilled. And Easter, we covered the verses that speak about, on Good Friday and Easter, we covered the verses that talk about the crucifixion and the resurrection. But what I want us to remember as we look through this trial, this disaster of a trial, that it was all exactly how it had to happen. Because Jesus is King and he is in control. Let's pray. Father, we watch Jesus go through these 40 verses and it seems like a disaster, like mayhem. Like things are out of control, but then as we think and read and know who you are, what we see is a sovereign God working his plan among the world to save his people. God, you are in control. Whether from the moments they had to choose Barabbas or from the moments that Jesus chose to be silent, to the moments in our life now, we know that you are in control. No matter how small, no matter how large, no matter how public, no matter how private, that you are sovereign. That you are King. And us sitting here, who have placed our faith in you and trust in you, that we will sing songs of you being King, of you being in control, and you being above all, and you being sovereign and all-powerful, the beginning, the end, the Alpha, Omega, until the day that we die, and then we'll sing and praise you for it in heaven. No matter what happens in this life, you are King, and you are in control, and you are sovereign. We thank you. We praise you for that. We love you. And I pray that you would bless this time. You would bless this week for us. That this week you would continue to draw your people to yourself. That we would not be a people that quench the spirit. But that we ask to be filled more and more and more with you and with your spirit. And that we'd be more and more transformed by your word. And how we look at life and interact in life and how we live our life would be defined and guided by your ultimate source of truth, your holy word, given to your people for all these things. We love you, and in Jesus Christ's name, amen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast by Cornerstone Church of Ione. We hope that you found it encouraging and challenging. Please feel free to share this podcast with friends and family, and we will see you all next week.